Welcome to the latest edition of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast. My name is Ben. I'm the owner of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery. I'm joined by Amy and Charles. How's it going, guys?
Pretty good. Can't complain.
Today we are continuing with our top five list. By the way, the top five list is a pop culture reference. And I don't know, if somebody comes up with what that pop culture reference, we should like send them a t-shirt or something. I did steal that idea from somewhere. So we are continuing with our top five list. And this week we are going to be talking about the top five most underrated saltwater aquarium fish.
This is a great topic to talk about. And it's so much different than the freshwater one in a lot of ways, partially because like a lot of the people who are really into freshwater fish have a group of fish that they're really into that they specialize in. But that doesn't happen as much in saltwater because most people who are keeping saltwater tanks just keep a community tank, at least most of the people that I know of. So it's sort of like we couldn't just say like we could say killifish almost because there's you have to get down to that specific fish, or at least that's what I found.
I approached this list very differently than I did the freshwater one, because the freshwater one, I felt like we were kind of picking kind of obscure versions of things people keep. Mm-hmm. At least for this one, I purposely was like, no, I'm going to pick fish that are readily available, but no one talks about or doesn't talk about enough.
All right. I think that's a good idea. The big challenge that I had with this list is, and I think it goes a little bit counterintuitively, people think of the oceans as being so grand and there's so many different kinds of fish in the ocean, mm-hmm. but there are actually significantly more different species of freshwater fish than there are saltwater fish. So when you look at an availability list from a freshwater wholesaler, it's way bigger than a saltwater wholesaler. So yeah. I actually had a little harder time coming up with my list of five.
I had a harder time getting to the list, but I think I feel more strongly about these ones.
Ooh,
like
love it.
They're fish that I really would love to see more of, and I don't get asked about like ever.
I think that means you should go first.
All right. Well, I think the first one I'm going to start with is going to be a really charismatic fish, and it's one that seems a lot more difficult than it is. And I chose this is actually one where I did choose a whole family, and that's the frogfish. Did anybody else put that? Because we do have one in right now, and he's really cool. So I was wondering if they did.
I think that's a fantastic choice. I thought about choosing some fish based on keeping species tanks,
yeah.
which is something you got to do for a frogfish because yeah. otherwise they're going to eat everything. And that's something I think that's overlooked often with saltwater keepers. They keep a saltwater aquarium, a mm-hmm. reef tank, and, you know, they're not as hard as they used to be. So
no.
keeping multiple saltwater fish tanks is not a bad thing. And so focusing on a species tank with a frogfish, I think that's a great idea.
Well, particularly because most nano tanks sort of functionally end up being species tanks anyway. You know, maybe you're going to have three or four fish, but they're easier if you just have like one big charismatic fish like a frogfish. These are like the perfect single nano reef inhabitant. They're an ambush predator. They can't swim. They can sort of swim.
They kind of crawl.
Yeah, they kind of crawl around. So you're not restricting their activity by putting them in a nano tank. Once they get used to where food comes from, they're always going to be out looking for it. They're always going to be looking at you. There are so many varieties. It's a pretty big family, and they are worldwide. Frogfish are found in every ocean except the Arctic. And there's even a freshwater frogfish. So, yeah, there's
part of the same family.
Mm-hmm, it's in the family. It's brackish, but actually okay. goes into full fresh in some areas. So, really species diverse and very individualized. They adapt to their specific environment, which means that there are bright orange ones, bright yellow ones. There are splotchy ones. There are black ones. There are brown lumpy ones like the one we have right now, which are still just as cute. So, there's a lot of different frogfish to choose from, and they're so easy to take care of. You feed them two or three times a week on frozen foods. They'll eat whatever you put in front of their face as long as it smells pretty good. So,
we did have to do some kind of fun acclimation with getting them converted over to eating frozen food, but it worked and it wasn't that difficult.
Yeah, and if it's one that's been at our wholesale facility, which we're lucky to have a fantastic saltwater wholesaler, if we know they've been there for a little while, they're usually already taking frozen by the time they get to us,
right.
and they definitely will be by the time they get through a quarantine. So at the end keeper stage, like they're so easy by the time they get to somebody.
Excellent, excellent fish choice. And actually one of my favorite saltwater fish is part of that group, the Sargassum anglerfish.
Mm.
Super cool fish. The Sargassum Sea is the only place those guys are found. For those not familiar, the Sargassum Sea is not technically a sea. It's an area of the central tropical Atlantic Ocean where the ocean currents cause the calm spot in the middle, and this really cool seaweed called sargassum weed grows there. It's a brown floating algae, and sargassum fish are found there. When I lived down in the Keys, I kept those for a while, and they're just funky, cool, crazy, cool personality fish. So
yeah, it's like if a fish could be from an island, right? That's how weird they are.
Only upside down.
Yeah, only upside down.
Yeah.
They do bring me to, yeah, you really can't keep frogfish with other fish because they will eat other fish and they will eat each other, and they can pretty much eat fish that are the same size as them. So
they have a remarkably sized mouth,
which makes them really, really fun to feed.
Yes, very extendable stomach. The one we have downstairs, I've been shocked by what it's decided that's what I want.
Yeah, you keep trying bigger and bigger, like silver sides with him, and he takes it every time.
Well, he's started rejecting smaller foods. He wants the bigger foods now.
Spoiled. They're one of those fish that does beg a name, though, because they're that personable.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You held up the bag of that fish, and you were like, oh, this is Lumpy. Just
instantly.
He is.
Yep, instantly gave it a name.
Yeah, they're that personable.
So. And how many fish can you keep in your tank where you can get to play Where's Waldo with all the time?
Depends on which one you get. Those bright yellow and orange ones, you're never going to miss.
Although, if you keep them in a tank that doesn't have any bright yellow and orange, that bright yellow or orange will fade.
Really? I thought some of that was species determined, but...
It's a mimic. So they're going to mimic a sponge, or they're going to mimic a coral, or they're going to mimic what kind of background they're sitting next to. So eventually, it takes a while, but it will change.
Hmm. Yeah, we've never gotten too many of those really bright ones in. The brown ones, to me, are just even fun enough without the color.
Oh, yeah. And the speed of that strike is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Excellent choice. I love it.
I was just going to say, the speed of that strike is shockingly fast. It's
every time.
Yeah. Even when you know it's coming.
Yeah.
Yep. Amy, that's an excellent choice. I love the species only idea. People should do more of that with saltwater fish.
Absolutely.
Yep. All right, Charles, what you got?
So I'm going to rearrange my list because I think it will flow better with this topic. I put a species on my list that I think lends itself to a species tank, and no one ever does it. Blue spot jawfish.
Mm.
I think that's a fish that, if you really want to do it justice, you should set it up in a tank by itself with a deep sand bed and build it as a rubble zone, less of a reef, maybe an edge of a reef, because that's a fish that is personable enough that I think it can handle display by itself and still be very interesting.
Now, you're not only saying that because you seriously considered doing that before you fell in love with those clownfish we got right now.
I have thought about it in the past multiple times, but it's largely because of their personalities. Like that one downstairs, he comes up and he is watching you when you're doing stuff outside the tank. And that's just a type of personality in fish I just can't ignore.
We found them to be a little hardier than like the yellow-headed jawfish too.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Personality sells a fish for sure.
Yeah, I can't argue with that at all. And they are really pretty, and not much else really looks like that either.
No, I can't think of anything that's got that ridiculous blue spot going on.
Polka dots.
A little bit of a rarity in the hobby. They do fetch a fairly commanding price these days. They are from the Baja area of Mexico. Fairly endemic to that area, maybe a little further south and a little further north here and there, but really that's a very area-specific fish and makes it sometimes hard to get, but when we can get them, they're amazing.
I've seen more and more people become aware of those fish. I've seen, you know, you start to see some pictures filtering in on forums and things like that, and everybody's like, what is that? It's that kind of fish where once you know what it is, you just kind of want it.
Yeah.
I can remember a time, and this is just more of an anecdote than anything else. I can remember a time where the price for those suddenly like tripled. And it was only because the Japanese aquarium market discovered them.
They found those fish, yeah.
And like the American industry couldn't get them for a while because everyone in Japan wanted them, which to be fair, yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? Although like with all the fish that are over there, they're looking at the ones that are on the other side of that ocean, but you can't blame them for that either.
It's also an area that goes through some fairly, we're going to call it changing political cultures.
Yeah.
So the Clarion Angel changes in price on a regular basis, and the Passer Angel changes in price on a regular basis. Those are other fish that are found not exclusively in those areas, but primarily found in those areas.
Yeah.
Yep. The other very cool reason for keeping that fish as a species tank is they really do better in a little bit cooler water than a lot of the other reef fish that we keep. So 78 is on the high range of the temperature for blue spot jawfish. So keeping those things on a little bit cooler, keeping them by themselves, or maybe with a couple of other cool fish that can handle that slightly cooler temperature.
And if you can limit your equipment by keeping just one fish, you might not need as powerful the stuff that's going to drive up the temperature past just what your heater is going to do. Then keeping a single fish is a way to limit how much equipment you need to keep your tank clean.
Yep, agreed. Well,
and that's a big that's a big part of the appeal of species tanks to me, because you can cater your system to whatever you're keeping, because when you're keeping a community, you're really making a decision of compromises on what you're doing and how what you can and can't get away with.
Yeah, if close enough.
Yeah, but if you're keeping a species tank, you don't have to make those decisions. You can just, this is the ideal for this fish, and there you go.
And it looks exactly what their natural habitat looks like, which to me is just makes it so much more fun to keep them.
Absolutely. Yep. Very cool fish. Excellent choice. Good job.
Well, Ben, what you got for us?
Well, I had to get this one in quick because I was afraid of it being I was afraid it would be on somebody else's list. So I'm going with the saddleback clownfish. I know we've been talking about them in a couple of relevant podcasts.
How can you stop?
Exactly.
I didn't put them down, so you're good. You're clear.
Good. They're not a very common fish in the hobby, and they're a great alternative to the clownfish that everybody else keeps. They get the same kind of great personality. You can keep them in a bigger group. So I had to put the saddleback clownfish on my underrated. To me, it perfectly fit the definition of, hey, what's an underrated reef fish that's available that should be in more tanks? That fit for me. Not a whole lot has to be said about that guy. They're very cool fish.
Yeah, I would love to see people do those instead of attempting to keep Oscillaris or Percula in a group, because it always ends in heartbreak, I think.
Right.
Somebody's going to get pushed out of the group.
Yep.
So the saddlebacks are much more likely to accept a situation like that.
Excellent. Excellent. So we will be keeping those in stock a lot more often, getting a lot more experience with those fish.
Yeah.
Yep.
I wouldn't complain about that.
Cool.
Me neither. I think that's a perfect segue. I'm going to skip Amy for a second.
Fine.
I put in my number.
I get to do two in a row.
Yep.
Yep.
I put in my number one spot. Originally wrote skunk clowns, and then I crossed it out and wrote wild type clowns.
Yeah.
Because I don't really have anything in particular against designer clowns. They're cool, and some of them actually represent wild polymorphisms. But there are like 30 species of clown, and I have never been asked about a skunk clown.
Which are super cute.
They're super cute, and like almost every system that I can think of that you would put a Percula or an Oscillaris, a skunk clown would fit, or a saddleback clown would fit. Like those are fish that, like, a lot of people keep designer clowns because there's a perceived uniqueness there, but I don't agree with that. And so when you can say, oh, I'm one of, like, I have sold 101 like skunk clowns to Platinum Perks, like, that makes the skunk much more rare.
I think you make a really good point there. I think that part of the whole reason for a discussion like this is, why are we looking for good alternative fish? And the reason that we're looking for alternative fish, or fish that are underrated that shouldn't be, is because we do want that different. We do want to try and keep something that's not like all of the other reef tanks out there. So that makes a skunk clown a perfect candidate. And oh, by the way, there may or may not be some of those coming in tomorrow.
Ooh, yay, I love skunks. But, like, it's such a good point. And I think so many reef tanks just blend together. They've got the same fish. They've got the same five types of corals. They look like a fruit stand. They've got a whole bunch of...
Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But there are so many other options. There are so many other things. There's a way that you can make it uniquely yours and look like nobody else's tank. And unique fish is a big part of that.
Definitely. Yep. Absolutely.
Yep. Well, I'm going to punish Charles for skipping my turn, because my next fish is a tang.
Oh, no.
But I chose the Tamini tang.
Okay, that's fair.
And I am one of those people that would not keep a Tang in a tank less than 100 gallons. A yellow Tang in a 75-gallon tank often makes me sad. So a Tamini Tang, as an alternative to that, they stay a little smaller. They get about 6 inches versus a yellow Tang or a Scopus Tang's more like 8 inches or so if it's full grown. And when we're talking about get up to, most Taminis are also going to stay less than 6 inches, just as most yellow Tangs are going to stay less than 8 inches. That's max size. So a little bit smaller, more available for smaller tanks than some of the bigger Tangs, which I really hate to see in them. Taminis, I think the reason that they're not that popular is because as juveniles, they don't often look that impressive. It kind of looks like a brown that sort of fades into an orange on the fin tips. But as they mature and that coloration deepens, they're more of like a dark gray to black with bright orange pointed fins and a bright white bluish tail.
That orange on those fins is striking.
It is.
They can
beautiful.
Be very gorgeous fish.
And the shape is so like elegant too. It's not rounded like some of the other Tangs. They mm-hmm. have that pointed fin, which is a really distinct profile that doesn't look even quite like the other fish in that genus, which is Tenocatus, by the way. And since they're part of that genus, which are the bristletooth Tangs, they're fantastic algae eaters, but so many of the other ones there are not pretty. So they're the pretty one, and they're still a good algae eater.
I think the coal is almost as pretty, but...
It's almost as pretty, but it's not as pretty, and it's overrated, and it's aggressive. And the Tamini is not.
Some of those Taminis can get a little feisty.
Not like the coal does, though. I've seen too many... more killer coals than I have Tamini Tangs.
That might be because you've seen less Taminis.
Maybe. I'd love to see more.
Going
Prove
in towards
wrong.
The end of a group, they can be just fine. If you put a Tamini in at the beginning, they can be as problematic as a coal.
It's still a Tang.
It's still a
so
Tang.
So it's still going to be territorial, but not that bad.
I do completely agree with them being in this discussion, though. Absolutely an underrated fish that we should do more of.
And
for sure.
Availability is there where it's not for really the yellows anymore. You can't get them unless you're getting captive bred or really True. Expensive wild caught ones. So as that availability of the yellow Tang starts to dwindle, we're starting to look at all other alternatives, and I'd love for the Tamini to be on everybody's list for alternatives to a yellow Tang.
I think that's a great choice. I like it. Yep. Excellent. So that's a perfect segue into, you know, you guys kind of skipped me at this point and I have a Tang on my list as well.
You?
Absolutely. Sorry, Charles. Wait, why are we apologizing to Charles for that? What was Charles' thing about Tangs?
Because I'm a person that says really 100 gallons plus for Tangs, and Charles is more likely to say, don't do a Tang.
Yeah. I sometimes feel a little, for me, Tangs are borderline on, does it belong in a tank? But that's big part of my like, well, these are roamers in the wild, whereas something like a goby or a clown, they're not. So I don't feel bad putting them in a tank.
I see the point. I've also seen a lot of tanks live for a very long time in tanks. And I think stressed fish have a shorter lifespan. And I think that can be a good indicator. As I say that out loud, I think there's all kinds of things that could be wrong with that statement. So I see where you're coming from. I don't agree with you.
Yeah, and I know you guys don't. And that's why I'm like, I'm just going to be honest on my opinion on it.
And that's the point of this. So please
continue
that.
I think I agree
that.
With you more times than I don't, but I can't hide the fact that I love Tangs.
They're gorgeous fish, and they are so interesting behaviorally.
Yeah, they're really personable. They're really easy to sort of tame and get used to you. And when they do, they're really rewarding pets to keep. And that's why I love them. And that's why I can't say don't keep Tangs. Because if I had the Tang to keep one, I would be keeping one.
Yeah. Like that purple Tang we have on the display. He's very personable and it's hard to not love him.
He's so spunky.
Right. But to your point, a blue Tang in a 55-gallon tank is like a goldfish in a goldfish bowl.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. It's a bad idea.
So if you're going to do it, choose one of the ones that are appropriate.
Like?
Like
a chocolate Tang.
Oh, I almost put
That's the one on my list.
Yeah.
Chocolate Tang. I think part of the unfortunate thing for a chocolate Tang, if chocolate Tang had a cooler name, we'd see them way more. People think chocolate, so a brown Tang, which they're... There's actually very little brown in a chocolate Tang. They're more of a grayish color that fades into blue with some really cool yellow edges. Mm-hmm. They are as hardy as any of the other tangs in the Zebrasoma genus, although they are in the Acantharis genus. Maybe even the hardiest of the Acantharis genus, but that's kind of a big word to say, the hardiest. Right. They don't have the ick-prone problems of some of the other tangs in that genus, like a powder brown or a powder blue. They don't get too big. They start out as a really cool juvenile fish in a really good yellow form.
I like the name mimic tang better for them for that reason, because their juvenile is a mimic.
Their juveniles, I was going to get into that.
Sorry, but that's why, because I also hate the chocolate tang name.
You're right.
Mimic tang is better.
Mimic tang is a great name. And so mimic tangs, one of my favorite features about mimic tangs is their juvenile form that mimics a species of dwarf angelfish. And different regions of where chocolate tangs are collected from, or mimic tangs are collected from, mimic different species of dwarf angelfish. There's one that mimics a lemon peel. There's one that mimics a flag fin. There's one that mimics an eblei.
And they're all pretty.
They're gorgeous. And it's still, they grow into the same looking adult, but as a juvenile, they mimic different angelfish. And one of the things I like so much about this particular type of mimicry is we can't quite figure out why they do it. And so the best prediction as to why a juvenile tang would mimic an angelfish has to do with intelligence. And not the intelligence level of the dopey tang, because tangs have, they're a little bit in that dopey category.
Let's call them the cows of the aquarium
world. Exactly. Nothing against cows. They're lovingly in their dopey way. But angelfish are one of the more, for the personification of it, intelligent of the fish world. And so the prediction is out there is the reason these juvenile tangs mimic dwarf angelfish is so that a predator looks at them and thinks, oh, that guy's smart enough to dart away from me or dart into a hole or too hard to catch because it looks just like an eblei angelfish or a lemon peel angelfish. So that's currently, that's the best theory as to why that mimicry is there. But I think that just makes chocolate tangs or mimic tangs just very cool. And then they turn into this gorgeous, majestic adult tang.
Yeah, I would love to see more people think about their reefs in that way. Most reef fish are pretty long-lived. So think about the fish for the duration of its lifespan. And a chocolate tang gives you two fish. It gives you the dwarf and it gives you the adult, and both are beautiful. So if you get one fish for a few years, it's eventually going to turn into another one entirely. And you still get to keep the same fish that you've grown up and loved. And like, thinking about that 10-year or so lifespan from your reef fish, it's a mindset that's more fun to get into, to see how things develop and see how things grow.
Definitely, for sure. I've kept an eblei tang next to an eblei angel, and the dynamic between the two fish is, it's kind of a cool behavior to watch. I haven't ever done that actually in a tank, keeping them together. That's maybe something we need to try and have a,
that'd be a fun experiment
to talk about. Yeah, yeah. I agree. Put that in the breeder lab category, Charles, where we can start thinking about that.
All right. Well, since Charles did too, I'll circle back to myself.
There we go.
This is going to be another bigger one for me, which usually I don't lean that direction, but I put the sargasm triggerfish, leading us back to the sargasm. But
excellent fish.
They're just as charismatic as a blue throat. I think they come out of their shells much quicker, actually. Usually when we get them in, they're out and begging and outgoing a little bit faster than a blue throat. They eat faster than a blue throat. They're not as vibrantly colored, but that pattern on them is just so unique and striking. And they have that bright orange tail, which is really beautiful as well. So they even a little bit more subtle, they've got that blue dusting on their eyelids, which you might not notice at first glance. But this is a fish that is going to evolve into a true pet. It's going to know you. It's probably going to let you pet it. It's probably going to, don't pet a trigger that you don't know. Bite your fingers off. But if you work with the fish long enough, if you gain its trust, if it gains your trust, right? That's a fish that can be a true pet. And we've had one here that was just such a blast to work with and be around. So when you're looking at smaller triggers, I would probably choose a sargasm over a blue throat most times, I think. Just for personality. I like their personalities better.
I'd have to agree with that. And I think that's something that sometimes gets lost in aquarium keeping, where people think, I want this type of fish because it's pretty. When you have a fish that can live 15, 20, 30 years, depending on the species, maybe you should be thinking about what its behavioral compatibility with you is.
I like that concept.
They are not invertebrate safe. They are not safe for small fish. They're going to be miserable in a small tank. I would say 200 gallons plus, but I've seen them in smaller setups that are well cared for that seem fine.
They're kind of okay with some smaller fish. They are not really, their target is not going to be preying on fish. They are a zooplankton predator.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that a sargassum fish, and actually that whole genus, the Xanthichthys genus, which includes the blue throat, the sargassum, and the really expensive one from Hawaii that I'm not thinking of right now.
Which one?
The really expensive triggerfish from Hawaii in the Xanthichthys genus.
I'm completely blanking on
crosshatch.
Oh, there we go.
Crosshatch
yes,
trigger. There we go.
A sargassum doesn't look too unlike a crosshatch in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Not quite as much color.
Right.
Yep. But all of those fish, their whole lifestyle is designed around eating things above them, mm-hmm. which is why they're less likely to eat benthic invertebrates. They're not completely devoid of taking out a benthic invertebrate. But
if they can catch it, they will.
Right, exactly. an interesting thing about those triggerfish with cleaner shrimp. In a tank that has established cleaner shrimp, it's often safe to add one of those triggerfish to one of those tanks with established cleaner shrimp. If you add a cleaner shrimp after those fish have been acclimated to that tank, it might not end well. But adding them to a tank with established cleaner fish or cleaner shrimp can work really well.
Yeah, it's sort of the same thing with small fish. If they're there when the fish gets in there, it's probably not going to mess with them unless it can actually eat them. So, like, don't drop a firefish on top of your sargassum triggerfish. That's just asking for trouble. But if you've got some clownfish in there or something like that, that's never going to be an issue, I don't think.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Excellent choice. A triggerfish for a reef tank. They are not as nasty as the undulated trigger or as a queen trigger, which are some of the riskiest fish to put in any fish tank. But the sargassum triggers, I'm gonna have to take over a little bit and say sargassum is their blue throats or crosshatches, anything from that genus.
And I won't say anything against them. I chose the sargassum because I think it's underrated.
Yep.
That doesn't mean the other ones are overrated, because I think they're appropriately rated. The sargassum needs to be up there with them.
Yep, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
I agree.
Me too.
And coral safe.
Yeah, coral safe.
Cool. All right, Charles, you get to go again.
All right. So I'm surprised that I managed to beat people to this one, but I put down captive bred mandarins. Mm.
Mm.
Now, what I'm going to say, I think also applies to captive bred fish in the hobby in general, but there's this whole aspect where there's a race to the bottom on pricing in the hobby, and I don't really agree with it. So almost 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, holy cow. Sorry, I just had one of those moments where like...
Yeah, man, you're so old.
I know. I'm not even 30. What's happening? Anyways, where we had people figure out how to breed these fish, and for so long, and to this day, people struggle to keep these gorgeous fish because the wild-caught ones don't really acclimate well to food in captive environments. They eat it in a very specific way. Yes, you can train them. It takes time.
And effort.
Lots of effort.
We've done it a lot, and it's not something that I would recommend the beginner aquarist do unless you've got a separate tank to acclimate them in.
For a wild-caught dragonette, you really have to design a tank around a dragonette.
Yeah. And a separate tank, probably just around acclimation, unless mm-hmm. you know that they're eating frozen foods by the time they get home to you, because they don't instinctively eat frozen foods.
No, and even for, quote-unquote, an experienced hobbyist, I wouldn't recommend it because it is a frustrating process.
Challenging.
And you often have to watch the fish that you're really excited to keep that you've been looking for a long time. You have to watch it waste away a little bit by the time it actually does start to take those frozen foods.
Yeah. And that's stressful to watch.
It is.
But the hobby was offered this captive bred alternative that would take pellet foods and frozen foods right off the bat. And the hobby as a whole said, I'm not interested because it costs more.
The wild caught ones are so cheap.
Yeah.
They're so cheap. And it was depressing to watch because I had thought for a long time that if someone figured that out, anyone would pay the price to keep that ridiculous looking fish.
That's how it should be.
I've heard of them taking pellets with their captive raised on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that is really scary for me. And this is me getting in my soapbox because I have talked a lot about how I think that we're reaching a point in the hobby where what we can figure out how to captive breed probably in the next 10 years is what the hobby's going to have. And
it's possible.
I think there's no way to know what the future will hold, but it's still something we need to support.
Yeah. But when you look at stuff like this, and if it's not economically viable, people aren't going to breed it. And so if people aren't breeding it and then we suddenly lose our source, that could be it for it in the hobby. That's like, we'll just not have it ever.
Yeah.
And so when people turn their nose up at something like that being offered just because of price point, it's scary for me to watch. And we are so lucky that hatcheries have started breeding mandarins again.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought they would take that risk again.
They kind of fit the two criteria for wanting captive raised fish. One criteria being availability of wild caught fish, i.e. the Bangai cardinal or seahorses. We can't get wild caught ones for good reasons, right? And the other reason is the wild caught ones just really don't do well. We can get a captive raised version that does really, really well. There should be a lot more of those fish in the hobby.
Yeah.
It's one that I've wondered why it hasn't been more attractive for hobbyist breeder projects. They shouldn't be too much harder to breed than, say, a clownfish. And you get a lot more spawning opportunities than you do with a clownfish. They spawn usually almost nightly when you have a pair that's, like, together. So you get a lot of opportunities to fail, which is part of what breeding is.
Yeah. Egg collection is the big challenge with those guys.
Yeah, I think the part that's intimidating to people is that they're a pelagic spawner.
Yeah.
And if you're going to pick a pelagic spawner, that's probably the one to start off with.
Yeah, like,
and it is well documented. That's right. Part of it to me. Right. Like, yeah, it's not the easiest thing to breed, but like there are steps listed out if you really want to dig into it. And it's not impossible. And they're not the most difficult saltwater fish to rear. So it's up there with breeder projects. They just look so exotic. They look so sensitive. They look so difficult that it's not as attractive as some of the other fish to try and breed. And I think if you're getting into that kind of project, it should be on your list.
I have to agree with that, especially if you're eventually thinking, oh, I want to experiment with angelfish or something that hasn't been bred yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think a mandarin is a perfect stepping stone to getting there because it's a well-documented pelagic spawner that has a, as far as pelagic spawners go, a pretty short larval stage.
Yeah. To look up how to breed a saltwater fish and get a step-by-step guide is a pretty rare thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool, very exotic fish. Definitely one of the most unique fish in the sea. Excellent choice.
Yeah. I don't want to say that people shouldn't keep them. I want to say that people should keep captive bred ones or ones that have been acclimated.
Yeah. Good choice. Good choice. So the next one that I am going with, I very specifically looked at my list of fish we don't want to see and tried to come up with some alternatives. And one of the groups of fish I chose on my, hey, these fish really shouldn't be used the way that they're used, was damselfish. So I thought I should include a damselfish on my list of underrated fish. And there's one of the damselfish that is actually a mimic of the jocularia angelfish, one of the pygmy angelfish, and it's called the Starkey damsel. And it's one of the few damselfish that doesn't turn into a big jerk. They are just as hardy as the rest of the damsels. They do fetch a higher price tag. They are a gorgeous, vibrant blue with a bright yellow face and yellow line that goes down their back. And of course, right now I just, you know, did the motion of...
He's miming a mohawk.
I'm miming a mohawk, right. Yeah. So the Starkey damsel, reef safe, very peaceful fish. They can hold their own, but they're not going to cause a lot of problems in a reef tank.
So pretty.
When we can get our hands on them, we always do.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that was my one of my top choices, actually. That was one that I didn't have to think about for underrated reef fish.
Yeah.
Particularly because of, you all know how I feel about most damselfish.
Well, the whole group, right? It's not even underrated. It's like despised. For the same reason, I put a damselfish on my list.
You did?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's the one I almost put on my list instead of the Starkey.
I think the one you almost put may have been the Allen's damsel.
Right.
Yeah, that's not the one.
Interesting.
Also underrated, really cool fish. I think they're underrated because they look lame in fish stores because they're all often like dark blue or black. But when they flash up in that,
when they get their color,
neon, it's fantastic. Yep. So I didn't put that one. I put the yellowtail damsel.
Interesting.
And hear me out.
All right. You're going to have to sell this one. You have to sell it for two reasons, by the way, just so you know.
The first reason it's underrated is it's so often used as a cycling fish.
Okay.
Which is stupid to begin with. I mean, if you don't know what that means, it means it's the fish that you add to your tank first to get it ready for other fish, to build up that beneficial bacteria that runs your tank. And usually people add a fish that they don't want, that they want to get rid of afterwards, or that they're fine with dying. And yellowtail damsels are so cheap, so they're a great one to use for that if that's what you want to do. But they're also pretty good, pretty usable reef fish in a lot of situations. They're small enough that they don't pose too big of a threat to most of our reef fish. They don't usually tend to go after a lot of fish that aren't like them, unless they're really close to them or in a smaller tank. But usually you'd be fine with most of the reef fish that we're going with. And they are actually a fish, while territorial with each other, that can be kept in groups in larger tanks. So they'll be comfortable with territories that are next to each other, as long as they're not overlapping, as long as you've got enough for them. So if you're looking for a fish to be in a group in a large tank, a yellowtail damsel is a better choice than a chromis.
You know, I have to admit, when you first said that one, I'm like, I don't know about that. But as I think it through, and I think through some of the criteria with underrated fish, one of the methods for choosing underrated fish is how they're used and introduced and how they should be used and introduced.
Yeah.
And if you've got an established reef tank with a pretty decent group of fish in it, and towards the end you add a group of yellowtail damsels, I bet that would work really, really well.
And it can sort of fill in your tank, where a lot of reef tanks look a little bit sparse, because when you think of a reef, it's densely packed, but you can't maintain those same kinds of territories in a tank.
Yeah.
So they'll sort of spread throughout your tank and fill in some of that middle ground. So consider it, you know, even if you consider not just using them as a cycling fish, but adding them to your tank later on as sort of just that nice, personable, hardy, brightly colored fish that sort of supports and shows off your cool main display fish.
I think I'm liking this idea. My hesitation also had to do with people start with those, just like you address that immediately. Like, don't use this as a fish to cycle your tank. It's a bad idea because we don't want disposable fish.
Right.
And if you set up a small-ish tank and you start out with a group of yellowtail damsels in the fish, or you start out with a group of yellowtail damsels in that tank, you're going to have a hard time introducing a lot of other fish to that tank.
Right.
But if you add those towards the end, a lot of other fish are not going to be able to mess with them, because they're still a damsel. They still have that feisty attitude.
Oh, sure. They're so spunky.
You're right. I love it. I'm sold. And I think I might look at putting some in the display.
And they even are really nice as just fundamentally in and of themselves to keep a nanofish.
Yeah.
The species tank. You know, we talked about that. A pair of yellowtail damsels and a 10-gallon, they would do just fine. They'll forgive you for your nano tank mistakes because they're very hardy. And they're really personable. I actually kept the yellowtail damsels, a couple of them, in with I had a smasher mantis shrimp. And that was a really fun tank to have those couple of damsels and that little guy. He wasn't a fish eater too much, and I was spoiling him a lot. So he never really went after him, and they kept to themselves, and it was a really fun tank.
That is an excellent and unexpected choice.
Yeah, nice job. I will admit, I wasn't sold until you brought up the point of, it probably would fit the bill for what people are trying with Chromis more often. I'm like, that's actually really true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we ever touched on it in the podcast, but our experiences with Chromis have not been they school in aquariums.
We talked about this a little bit with the fish that we recommend you not keep episode, right. which is groups of Chromis. So this is the great alternative to that, I think. Mm-hmm. That's how I came to it.
Oh, good.
And actually, we've got a service technician here who like champions this fish in his reef tanks. So he inspired me a little bit on that too.
Nice. Nice. Excellent. That was good, Amy. That was unexpected. I like it. Well done.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have a quick honorable mention because everyone else here picked a damsel and it almost made my list. The Allen's damsel would have made my list.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
If I was going to pick a damsel, that's the one that I truly enjoy.
Seems like it got knocked off the edge of all of our lists, actually.
It was so close. And the only reason for me was the Starkey damsel. If I had to choose between a Starkey and an Allen's, I would take a Starkey every day.
Yeah.
Allen's show up a little bit more often, so they're a little bit more available.
Mm-hmm.
So we get them more often.
Yeah.
But that's it. Allen's damsel belong on the list. Excellent. Honorable mention, Charles.
So, but this one for me was in the vein of as an alternative to something else on our list.
Like it?
On our list of do not keeps.
Mm-hmm.
So I can remember a time where every time you walked into a local fish store, you would see cleaner wrasses.
You're taking one of my fish, and that's okay.
Every single time. And so my alternative to that is neon gobies.
Yep, absolutely.
Because if you want a cleaning station in your tank, that's the fish to go for because they are not an obligate slime coat eater. And
like a cleaner wrasse.
Yeah, and they're captive bred. They're readily available. They're very hardy.
They're so cute.
They are adorable. There are dozens of species and like 6 to 8 of them are at least available occasionally captive bred.
With 2 or 3 being available almost all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you have options and they're all gorgeous, personable, and there's just something so satisfying about sticking your hand into a tank full of cleaner gobies and they like swarm your hand.
Yeah. Yeah. For being like an inch long, they're fearless.
They are. Oh, yeah. And by the way, that whole sticking your hand in the tank and having them clean, that works in the wild too.
Oh.
I have been in the Caribbean and had cleaner gobies clean my hand scuba diving.
I love it.
Amazing little fish. Yep. Excellent choice. I wonder if it would work with cleaner gobies if we used those. So we're hesitant about using a fish to cycle a tank, although we kind of do that with clownfish. I don't know if that would work with cleaner gobies. Like if you established your group of cleaner gobies, they're so little.
The bio load is low.
Right.
And really the only reason we're against using fish to cycle a tank is because we're talking about cycling a tank cold.
Yeah.
Like if you're cycling with live rock and live sand, then you're not purely cycling the tank with a fish. You're cycling the fish with, or you're cycling the tank with a whole bunch of beneficial bacteria, and the fish are just keeping that going. So they would be a really good one for that.
As a first fish, get that population of cleaner gobies established in a tank and then build the whole population around that. I would be suspicious that a lot of those fish that we'd be concerned about eating a small cleaner goby, if there's an established cleaning station, I just did air quotes over the air, by the way. If there's an established cleaning station in your reef tank, and then all these other fish get introduced, I think that could be better for everybody.
Well, and a cleaning station is a really well-proven stress reliever. It's like the fish spa, and that's something that's pretty well documented too. So if they could help you acclimate some of your new fish and make them realize that, hey, this place isn't such a bad place to live after all, that'd be a really good idea.
Yeah, and I kind of love that because I do remember a time with cleaner wrasses. They're like, it's not going to live very long in your tank, but it's better for all the rest of your fish. And I'm like, well, we have an alternative. Why aren't we doing that?
Right, right.
Yeah, and I have seen them like in tanks that we've had here where we just sort of got them in QT with some other fish. And I've seen them actively pick parasites off of fish too. So if you ever have an issue with that in your tank, they can be a little bit of a helper to you too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will also say an amazing candidate for a nano reef.
Sure.
Definitely.
Like
if, even a Pico Reef almost.
Like, yeah, they're breeding those in 10-gallon tanks.
Yeah.
With groups, not just with two fish, right, but with a group of small fish in a 10-gallon tank.
Yeah, if you just want like a small colony of something in a 10-gallon,
yeah,
that's the fish in my mind.
Definitely.
Yeah, and yep, so brightly colored.
Excellent choice.
Yeah.
Yep, very cool.
Wait, is that both of your last one?
No, I have one more.
Okay, okay.
I have one more as well.
Okay, just yeah, making sure. Just make
yeah
sure.
Yeah. I'm gonna stick to the captive raised and captive bred category here. And it's a fish that I really hope we can find again. A fish that I kept years ago and was just an amazing fish in a reef tank. It's the yellow assessor. You guys are probably not all that familiar with them.
I didn't even know this fish.
They're about the size of a royal grama.
Okay.
And they typically inhabit reef ledges.
They sound really judgmental.
I have seen one in the entire time I've been in the hobby.
I had a pair for a while, and they were great. They're not a super bold yellow, but they're still a good yellow, right?
Yellow,
they're not
yellow
tang yellow. They're more like yellow damsel yellow, but they're not a jerk like a yellow damsel.
Right.
They will hold their own against anybody, but they won't have attitude towards anybody. They are in the Dottyback, Grama, Serenidae would be the family, so the true bass family, which is what we're groupers and Dottybacks and Gramas and the basslets, that's all that same group. One of the really fun features about the assessors is because they live on ledges and water is buoyant and they have swim bladders, they can make themselves neutrally buoyant, and they orient themselves to whatever their surface is, and they maintain that orientation. So, for example, if in your tank, against your rock ledge, they decide that the side of a wall is where they're going to consider the bottom is. There's the air quotes again. Sorry about that. So they're consider that their bottom. They will swim and as though that side of the tank is the bottom of the tank. And when you feed, they will come out to feed like a happy, outgoing, gregarious feeding fish, but they'll come out and they'll swim sideways the whole time.
Oh, that's so bizarre.
Right. It's so fun to watch, which means if they happen to orient themselves to an upside down ledge, they will come out upside down and swim upside down the whole time when they're coming out to feed. And it'll change based on how they happen to be orientated when you put the food in the tank.
That's so fun. We often think of our tanks as sort of two-dimensional objects. You know, yeah, you've got yeah the display and you set it up like a picture frame. So to remind ourselves that the ocean is in three dimensions.
Exactly. That's what the
really
assessor
cool
does.
Thing.
And they do it really well. They were available captive raised for a while. I'm going to reach out here to some of our captive breeding wholesalers and see if they still have some pairs lying around so they can get some of those fish. But that to me is an underrated fish that was around for a while. It was in the hobby and it fell out of favor for no other reason than other fish became more popular.
Yeah, and it's so underrated. I didn't even know about it.
Mm-hmm. That one was an easy, oh, that's going on my list.
Very
so
cool.
So there we go. The yellow assessors, look them up. There's three or four different species of assessors, by the way, not just the yellow ones. All of them are just as cool. The yellow ones were just the ones I had experience with.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a pretty good transition to my last fish, which is the chalk bass. So another one of those little fish in that group. So outgoing, so hardy, really fun fish to work with. We've had them in a couple of times, and it had always been like, hey, what's that? Oh, I want it. Let me take that. You know?
They do move quick.
Yeah. Yep. But nobody's ever asked me about it. I've never gotten somebody order in a chalk bass. And so I think it's just one that people don't know about. They have that sort of bright blue green that a chromis has, but with these burgundy vertical bars on them that are really pretty. These fish are so small, but to me, they act like a much bigger fish.
Oh, definitely.
They've got the personality almost of like a grouper. Like
no, I
100% like
agree. They are definitely a small package, like, yeah, but big right personality.
And you do have to watch the attitude of those guys because
oh, yeah,
they can get a little on the feisty. Not quite like a royal Dottyback or a strawberry basslet, but they can be a little on the feisty side.
I mean, if you think of them as like a mini sea bass, right?
Yeah,
which is
exactly
what they are.
That's exactly what they are, yeah.
You treat them like that, but they only get 3 inches long.
Super good personality.
Yeah. So it would be another good candidate for a species tank, mm-hmm, but in a community tank, in most reef communities that I know of, they would do just fine. You wouldn't want to keep them with like other like basslets. Probably not a tank with a royal grama, but they would be a great alternative to a royal grama if that's not your jam.
I feel like this is the moment where I say, when you're picking something in that group, you kind of have to commit to just the one, because like grammas don't really get along with most dottybacks and vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some exceptions, but that's generally true.
I think a chalk bass, you could do a little more mixing actually, because a chalk bass is more of a sand-dwelling open water fish.
It has a different body shape too.
Yeah. And they're not going to compete with the territory, right? The three triggers for aggression or territorialness: are you going to steal my house? Are you going to steal my food? Or are you going to steal my girlfriend?
No, I'm not.
Okay, but the fish. And the chalk bass is going to live in a different house and therefore think of different food sources than a dottyback or a grama. So I would suspect, and we should try it, I would suspect that in an area where they can set up their own territories, not necessarily even in a huge tank, but just where there's a little bit of a rock ledge for the mm-hmm. grammas or the dottybacks, and a little bit of an open sandy area for the chalk bass, well, I think it would work.
And chalk bass do tend to live in sort of loose aggregations in the wild. Mm-hmm. They're found often near each other. Mm-hmm. They have smaller territories than some of the other fish. Mm-hmm. In an aquarium, you always got to assume that their territories...
The whole tank.
Yeah, the whole tank. But it has been reported that you can keep groups of them in carefully planned tanks around it. And it's a fish that I think, just based on personality, based on their beautiful color, it would be worth planning around.
Let's try some more.
Yeah.
I like it.
I actually got a lot of my chalk bass information from a tropical fish hobbyist article. Edward Jackson wrote a fantastic article about them, about how underrated they are. When I was looking up this fish, that popped up and I'm like, oh, I agree with everything he has to say. So nice. Look that up.
All right, Charles.
So for my last one, I put dottybacks, just in general as
in
a group.
In general. It's a big group.
It is. I'm kind of honing in on the Pseudochromis genus specifically, mm-hmm. because like you and I are both very biased against the Pictochromis genus, which is like the royals, the bicolors.
I
don't like them.
I don't want to use hate as a strong word, but I really, really, really don't like them.
They are so, anyways,
they're so mean.
They are so mean. But I feel like dottybacks are a pretty diverse group. The family has like 150 species, and everyone thinks they're all jerks. But you look at things like orchid dottybacks and neon dottybacks, and most reef setups could handle those. But even some of the more pushy dottyback species, I think they're perfect candidates for larger nano tanks, where you're like, oh, I'm only going to have one fish. And in my opinion, if you're only going to have one, you want it to look insane.
Right.
And you want it to have a lot of personality and be brave, so it'll be out. In my head, that's a dottyback.
That's a dottyback. Right.
And so with all those species available, you have a lot of options. Like, do you want to do something insane? Like, I'm going to jump into another genus, but like the Siphoperperensis. Like,
that's the Splendid, right?
That's the oblique-lined one. The Splendid, I think, is a... I can't remember the genus
names. I don't remember
either. But they're kind of pushy.
The oblique-lined ones, those are some of the big, nasty ones, aren't they?
No. Those... I think you're thinking of the...
Which one's the oblique line?
They're the bright red ones with, like, the blue edge on their scales. So it looks like oblique lines. But they only get, like, 3 inches.
Uh-huh. Okay, so little nasty.
Little nasty. And that's why I'm like...
Important distinction.
Little nasty. Yeah. I will not say they are a peaceful fish.
Those are draw blood kind of fish, Charles.
But if you're setting up a tank that's like 15 gallons and you're like, oh, I just want one fish that's insane.
Okay. Yeah. That would fit that category. You're right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Which, I mean, maybe that's what we're getting at here, which is that tank itself is an underrated tank.
Yeah, I feel like
the single species nano, that is.
There is a attraction to stuffing a tank with as many things as you can. And I understand that. Mm-hmm. We've all been there.
And when you go on, when you dive on a coral reef, it kind of looks that way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not unnatural to see all of these like different kinds of fish just jammed together.
Yeah. But if you take a picture of like 5 square feet on the bottom or whatever, you know, you could see an environment yeah. that looks like what we're talking about, mm-hmm. which is basically this is where this fish lives.
Yeah.
The reef is composed of, depending on who you're talking to, dozens or hundreds of microhabitats. And given the size of the average aquarium, it makes sense to me to try and emanate those microhabitats and not the entire reef in like 3 square feet.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's a great idea. Now, dot effects are something I have beyond the neon, which I love, and the orchid, which I love. I don't have much experience with any of them because people don't want them, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder, I'm always curious about how much of that is founded. Like, if you're talking about your Sipho purpurensis, if you had a 220-gallon reef, let's talk about our reef display that we have downstairs, yeah. a 220-gallon reef that has a paraclownfish, some bigger tangs, some a sargassum trigger, doesn't have a royal grama, doesn't have any wrasses in it. Why couldn't you keep that tank? Is it going to attack your tangs and rabbit fish and triggers
yes.
and
yes.
clownfish?
Yes. I will fully admit, dottybacks, I feel like, have earned their reputation as being aggressive and pushy.
In the royal dottyback and the strawberry basslet. Those, yep. right. yes. But an orchid dottyback or a neon dottyback in that tank would go great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, sorry. But I feel like just because some species are that aggressive doesn't mean, A, you can't keep them. You just need the tank for them. Mm-hmm. And B, doesn't mean that all dottybacks are like that.
Right.
Well, and I have any mad respect for a 3-inch fish that can take on an 8-inch trigger.
But, and the strawberry basslet would fit that category. One of the yeah. reasons that I dislike those fish so much goes right into my reasoning for disliking the blue devil damsel or the domino damsel. There's nothing wrong with those fish. They have their place. They belong. They don't belong in the hands of a beginner.
Yeah.
Right? And so a strawberry basslet is a $15 to $20 fish that is absolutely gorgeous and brutally hardy. They are very, very hard to kill. And so they are sold as a beginner fish. And if you're only going to keep that fish, it's a fantastic beginner fish. You're going to have a hard time killing it.
Right.
Right. And even keeping one of those with a domino damsel, that might actually work.
If you're lucky, though, that's the distinction.
No. Those two together, they'd probably be fine.
Okay.
Right.
They're both very capable of standing up for themselves.
Yeah. And in probably even against each other. I don't think it would be there was a TV show like who would win between these two fish? No, I don't know that there's necessarily going to be a clear winner or a clear loser. I think both of those fish would probably work it out and say, all right, I can't hurt you. Let's just.
Yeah. Unless one of them gets the right upper hand that, and that's just aggressive tanks in general, right?
Just don't keep anything else with those fish. But if you kept a Starkey damsel and an orchid dotty back, it's a completely different tank.
Yeah. And you could still have your Nemos in that tank.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. I like one of the, I feel like this discussion is going in a couple of really cool directions. And one of them is there aren't enough species tanks in saltwater or tanks designed around keeping some very specific fish. Mm-hmm. And I'll even go out on a limb here and say, okay, a species tank, like a tank just for anglers, or if you really love strawberry basslets and you want to keep a domino damsel and nothing else.
Why not?
There shouldn't be something wrong with that.
Right.
Right. But then also some of those fish that can be fantastic additions to some established tanks, like an orchid or a neon dottyback, or an assessor, or saddleback clowns, or cleaner gobies. And I think that there's some really cool different directions here, some really cool new ways to think about add-on fish or saltwater tanks that we don't usually think about.
Yeah, and I want to address that I think part of the reason people don't keep tanks like that is because saltwater is expensive. Right. So if you've saved up and you've bought your big reef tank, of course you want a little bit of everything. Of course you want a little piece of everything because that's usually the only one big display that you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
But these single species tanks or these smaller nanos don't necessarily need to be that expensive or that difficult. Pricing out, we've got a 10-gallon nano downstairs. That's really not that much more expensive or more difficult to take care of than a freshwater tank. It's all about limiting your bio load, limiting how much waste goes into the water. It's all about keeping the tank clean and making sure you're using RO water instead of tap water and all those little things that beginners get into trouble with. Because oftentimes beginners are the ones trying nano tanks and they're the ones making those mistakes. So if you've got a little bit of aquarium knowledge, you can apply that to a nano saltwater tank. It doesn't have to be that expensive, although you do tend to have to buy the water, which is a big expense. But if you keep your waste load low, you probably don't need a protein skimmer. You could probably use a hang-on-the-back filter versus a sump, which cuts out a ton of the expense. So for those of you who may be listening that are freshwater keepers, that's going to transfer a lot better to this type of tank than it might to the big mixed reef.
Setting the goal on a specific fish.
Yeah.
That, I like that.
That sort of makes everything simpler.
Yeah. Maybe a next podcast could be the top five species only saltwater fish for under $200.
Yeah.
Like not the fish, but the setup. Like, okay, let's set up a really simple 20-gallon saltwater aquarium and keep it as a species tank.
Yeah.
I digress though. We're going off topic here a little bit.
But even if you're filling a 10-gallon with freshwater fish, it's probably 15 or 20 neon tetras. Mm-hmm. And that costs about the same as one of those frogfish, which are pretty expensive fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. So
that's my only point about that.
I like it. I like it. I think this is a pretty cool discussion. I think it's always fun when we do this. By the way, one thing that we didn't say at the beginning of the talk. So the way that we set these talks up, we don't know what the other person's going to say. We all came with our own lists. We all came with our own ideas. So this was us sitting here talking about some really cool fish ideas. That's what we're hoping you guys are going to bring to this discussion. We want to hear what your thoughts are, some of your ideas on some underrated saltwater fish.
Absolutely.
Tell us what you guys think.
Absolutely. Yeah, and please reach out to us wherever. We've got Facebook, we've got Instagram, we've got YouTube. Send us an email, check out our website. Post a comment under this podcast if you're listening to it on our website. Make sure to rate and review us on iTunes. But really, we want to hear from you. We want to talk to you. And this is our chance to do that.
Yep. Let's keep the discussion going. And in the meantime, there you go. The top five underrated fish in the aquarium hobby, saltwater aquarium hobby. Let's keep it lots of fun and keep those hands wet. Thanks for listening.